Our security, our prosperity, and our very freedoms are interconnected, in my view, as never before. And so, I believe we must work together as never before.
President Biden addresses the UN and calls on the world to work together. The question is, what do the French have to say about that? Plus, more migrants surge to the southern border, testing the White House strategy on immigration. The question is, what is the White House strategy on immigration? And the U.S. military's newest service, the Space Force, unveils its dress uniforms. The question is, do the new threads boldly go where Captain Kirk already was? It's way too early for this. Good morning, and welcome to Way Too Early, the show that has a fancy new set. I'm Jonathan Lanier on this Wednesday, September 22nd. We'll start with the news. Facing cascading crises at home and abroad, President Biden used his first speech before the United Nations General Assembly yesterday to call for global unity.
As we look ahead, we will lead. We will lead on all the greatest challenges of our time, from COVID to climate, peace and security, human dignity and human rights, but we will not go it alone. We'll lead together with our allies and partners and in cooperation with all those who believe, as we do, that this is within our power to meet these challenges, to build a future that lifts all of our people and preserves this planet. But none of this is inevitable. It's a choice. And I can tell you where America stands. We will choose to build a better future. We, you and I, we have the will and capacity to make it better. Ladies and gentlemen, we cannot afford to waste any more time. Let's get to work. Let's make our better future now. We can do this. It's within our power and capacity.
In his speech, the president looked to repair many of the alliances strained by the Trump presidency, even as the current administration deals with issues of its own. In addition to the pandemic still raging at home, a deal to sell nuclear submarines to Australia was harshly received by French leaders last week, who said it undercut an agreement of their own. And the White House is still dealing with the fallout of last month's messy withdrawal from Afghanistan. Last week, the Pentagon announced that a drone strike, which was initially thought to have killed two ISIS-K fighters, instead killed 10 civilians. For the first time since early March, COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. are averaging more than 1,900 a day. Health experts say the vast majority of the hospitalized and dead have been unvaccinated. According to data from Johns Hopkins University, nearly 64% of the U.S. population has received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. Meanwhile, the average deaths per day has climbed 40% over the past 2 weeks. In an effort to help curb the latest deadly wave, President Biden is doubling down on testing. Bloomberg reports that according to an official at the Department of Health and Human Services, the federal government is spending nearly $1.2 billion to purchase 187 million rapid COVID-19 tests from Abbott Laboratories and Celltrion. It's part of an investment of about $2 billion announced by the Biden administration earlier this month to make the rapid tests more widely available. Joining us now, Reuters White House correspondent Jeff Mason. Jeff, thank you so much for getting up so early with us this morning.
My pleasure, Jonathan.
Let's start with what happened yesterday in New York with the United Nations. What have you heard in terms of the people you've talked to in and around the administration as to how the White House thinks the speech went over, and what's been the reception abroad?
Well, I think the White House is pleased with how the speech went over. I think they were trying to set out a message, as you saw with what he said, that he is ending this 20-year period of war and focusing on diplomacy. I thought it was interesting that he did not actually mention the word China or Beijing, but that certainly hung over his remarks, as it does over really all of his foreign policy. In terms of reaction, you know, there was instant or pretty quick criticism from Republicans, so domestic critics, that the president has not lived up to what he said in that speech with regard to diplomacy. And of course, you have the issue of the French, which you mentioned already, which is, one of the United States' oldest allies and they are not viewing what the administration did with that submarine deal with Australia and Britain as a sign of reestablishing or cementing ties.
And isn't it interesting, Jeff, that the president, his two meetings yesterday were with the prime ministers of Australia and the United Kingdom, those who in that submarine deal. But aides have said that he'll be speaking to French President Macron in the coming days. He'll have some fences to mend. Jeff, you also had a piece out on the upcoming announcement from the president about donating more COVID doses abroad. Tell us what you know. The U.S., of course, has received some criticism for not being enough of a selfless international partner when it comes to these doses and for prioritizing boosters here in the U.S. before a lot of the world even has had one shot. Tell us what you know about this.
Well, that's exactly right, Jonathan. And it's that last piece that has gotten the most criticism recently, that the United States is moving to give boosters to Americans who have already become or are already fully vaccinated when there are millions and millions of people around the world who haven't had even one shot. So I think what the president and what the White House want to do today at the virtual COVID summit that he is hosting is say, look, the United States is setting the example. Yes, we are vaccinating our own people, but we're also donating lots and lots of vaccine to the rest of the world. And doing that now with adding an additional 500 million doses to the already 600 million doses that they had announced before. But the criticism is not going to go away. I mean, this will certainly help the world to deal with the pandemic, but It's September of 2021 now. These doses aren't going to get out until January at the earliest. And as we both have said, a lot of people in other countries, poor countries, middle-income countries, would like to get shots right now.
Jeff, this feels like a pretty important week for this White House. Sort of the backdrop here is, of course, what's happening here at home and his agenda on Capitol Hill with Democrats not able to agree on that reconciliation package, the bipartisan infrastructure deal, the fate of those things both hang in the balance as progressives and moderates jockey for what they want in there. But this week, centrally, as you've been covering so closely, is about foreign policy. So tell us a little bit more about this vaccine summit today, but also some of the other meetings the president has this week, including with the Quad allies, and how so much of that is about China.
Sure. So first today, we'll kick off with that COVID summit, and they're planning to have it's a virtual summit, but it's on the margins of the UN General Assembly with leaders around the world already tuning into that and now tuning into the summit. The United States wants to challenge world leaders to do more to vaccinate their own people. The U.S. is encouraging the rest of the world to set a goal of having 70% of nations' populations vaccinated by this time next year. Roughly by the time that the UN General Assembly meets again in 2022. So that's where he kicks off in terms of foreign policy today. Yes, he does have this meeting with the Quad. The White House is billing it as the first in-person meeting of that group at the White House. Of course, that again comes in the backdrop of what's going on with France and that submarine deal. But domestically, Jonathan, they also have that meeting today. He's chewing gum and walking at the same time with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer to deal with those huge domestic bills and priorities that, as you say, are facing some challenges within his own party.
So much going on, and we'll be following it all very carefully. Reuters White House correspondent Jeff Mason, thank you, my friend. Come back soon. Still ahead, Congressman Sean Casten joins us to discuss one of the other major challenges requiring global cooperation, highlighted by President Biden at the UN yesterday, climate change. Plus, where teams stand in Major League Baseball's push to the playoffs with less than 2 weeks remaining in the regular season. Is that a home run over the Green Monster by the Boston Red Sox? Yes. Those stories and a check on the weather when we come right back.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Ohtani, deep and high and gone and 45.
That was crushed. Angels two-way star Shohei Ohtani going deep for the first time since September 10th. The solo shot in the eighth inning is Ohtani's 45th of the season, putting him one off the Major League lead behind a tie between Toronto's Vlad Guerrero Jr. and Kansas City's Salvador Perez. They each have 46. But it's not enough to put L.A. past the AL West leading Houston Astros, who rode four home runs to a 10-5 victory and reduced their magic number to clinching another division title. That's down to four. To Denver, and a tie game between the Dodgers and the Rockies before L.A.'s Albert Pujols delivers a go-ahead pinch-hit single in the top of the 10th. The Dodgers hang on to win it 5-4. But in San Diego, the Giants answer with some late-game heroics of their own. Lamont Wade Jr. drives in the go-ahead run in the top of the 9th to lift San Francisco to a 6-5 win over the Padres. The Giants maintain a one-game lead for first place in the National League West over the Dodgers with 11 games to play, home field advantage at stake. Meanwhile, the Cardinals notch 10th win in a row, the club's longest streak since 2001, by beating the Brewers 2-1 last night. The win keeps a firm grasp on the second NL wildcard spot for St. Louis, and their lead increased over the Reds to 4 games. Cincinnati lost to Pittsburgh earlier in the night. Standings in the three-team race for the two AL wildcard spots remain unchanged. A go-ahead two-run homer in the 5th, and then a two-run double in the 6th from my man Xander Bogaerts lifts the Red Sox over the Mets 6-3. That's Boston's 6th win in a row. In St. Petersburg, Florida, the Blue Jays improved to a league-best 16-4 in September. They won 4-2 over the AL East leading Tampa Bay Rays. And at Yankee Stadium in the Bronx, 3 home runs power New York to a 7-1 win over the Texas Rangers. The Red Sox remain the AL wildcard leader, 1.5 games ahead of the Blue Jays in the second spot, while the Yankees sit a half game behind Toronto, currently out of playoff position. And finally, MMA star Conor McGregor may be a knockout in the ring, but yesterday proved he is mortifying on the mound. McGregor appeared at Wrigley Field to throw out the ceremonial first pitch before the Cubs took on the Twins, and my God, you could say that toss was just a bit outside. While the power was there, McGregor blamed the inaccurate throw on an injured left leg. To be fair, it was broken, but goodness, that was pretty terrible. Time now for the weather. Bill Cairns, I trust you could throw a better first pitch than that. What do you think of our new set? And tell us what we got for the forecast today.
Yeah, I like that. You're looking spiffy this morning. Sometimes I wonder if they throw these first pitches out like purposely bad so they get the headlines at least. Because if they just throw it normal, no one's ever going to know about it, right? So let's get into this forecast. It is now humid in the Northeast again. I hope you enjoyed your nice little string of dry, beautiful fall weather. The Ohio Valley got soaked yesterday. It is still raining. This is a slow-moving rainstorm that is now going to pour this morning. Indianapolis, Louisville, Lexington, Cincinnati, Nashville, umbrella weather for you. D.C., make sure you have your umbrella. Roanoke, Pittsburgh, all the way through western New York, too. And because it's been obviously a very wet summer, now heading into fall this afternoon, 15 million people are in flash flood watches, including State College, to Philadelphia, Harrisonburg, to Roanoke. We actually have a couple flash flood warnings just to the west of Roanoke, and we still have a flash flood watch from Myrtle Beach down to Wilmington, where it's poured over the last 2 days. So how much rain can we expect over the next 3 days? Today, it's going to rain hard from Indianapolis to Columbus, and then for about 2 days, it's going to rain really hard in central Pennsylvania, even up to about 4 to 5 inches of rain. So that's why we're concerned with flash flooding there in the higher terrain from Charlottesville to Harrisonburg back up through central PA. And we may even have some isolated severe weather today. Watch out around Pittsburgh. It's a gusty, strong wind, maybe an isolated tornado, but the wind damage is the biggest threat. And the timing of all of this, as we go throughout this afternoon, you see all the heavy rain around Pittsburgh to Roanoke, and then then by the time we get to Thursday, slow moving over the top of D.C. Notice it doesn't get to New York City until late Thursday into Friday morning. So it's going to take a while to move through this region. So for today's forecast, slow moving heavy rain threat, Ohio Valley into the mid-Atlantic. Notice that the middle of the country is nearly perfect and no problems in areas of the west. So umbrella weather has returned along with that dreaded humidity for many on the East Coast.
Bill Cairns, thank you for the forecast and for calling me spiffy. I appreciate it. Still ahead, where is Brian Laundrie? The FBI is now asking for the public's help in finding him after the body of Gabby Petito was discovered in the woods of Wyoming. The latest on that search next on Way Too Early.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
A new report claims the FBI held back a decryption key for almost 3 weeks earlier this summer, which could have helped hundreds of businesses targeted by a major ransomware attack. According to U.S. officials who spoke with the Washington Post, the FBI held onto the key in part because it did not want to tip off the hackers about a takedown operation. In July, the group known as R-Evil allegedly attacked a Miami-based IT company, affecting up to 1,500 businesses. Analysts estimate that millions of dollars could have been saved had the FBI provided businesses the decryption key sooner. Meanwhile, yesterday, the U.S. Treasury Department made a first-of-its-kind announcement, saying it will sanction a cryptocurrency company for its alleged role in laundering ransomware attacks. Meanwhile, FBI Director Christopher Wray says the U.S. is opening new counterintelligence investigations into China as often as every 12 hours.
There's no shortage of dangers to defend against. On the cyber front, we're now investigating over 100 different types of ransomware, each with scores of victims. And that's on top of hundreds of other national security and criminal cyber threats we're working against every day. Protecting our nation's innovation, we're opening a new China counterintelligence investigation every 12 hours. There is no doubt about it. Today's threat is different from what it was 20 years ago, and it'll almost certainly continue to change.
Wray testified before the Senate Homeland Security Committee yesterday about the threats to the U.S. This was not the first time he sounded the alarm on Chinese espionage. In a speech last year, Wray said the threat from China was, quote, the greatest long-term threat to our nation's information and intellectual property. The Biden administration is facing bipartisan criticism over the growing unrest at the border. Republican lawmakers have repeatedly slammed the White House, saying it isn't doing enough to stop what they call a crisis at the border. And Democrats, citing recent reporting of the treatment of Haitian migrants, say the president needs to stop the deportations.
Right now, I'm told there are four flights scheduled to deport these asylum seekers back to a country that cannot receive them. Such a decision defies common sense. It also defies common decency and what America is all about. The policies that are being enacted now and the horrible treatment of these innocent people who have come to the border must stop immediately.
Administration officials are speaking out against viral images appearing to show Border Patrol agents on horseback corralling migrants. Vice President Kamala Harris said she was, quote, deeply troubled about it. And Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas called them unacceptable. And in Haiti, violence broke out as the U.S. officials deplaned deported migrants. A group of Haitians assaulted pilots and injured three ICE officers after they were released in Port-au-Prince. The Teton County coroner has announced that it has identified the human remains found in Wyoming as Gabby Petito's. While the search resumes in Florida for her fiancé, who is a person of interest in the case, NBC News national correspondent Miguel Almaguer has more.
Gabby Petito's body was officially identified, the coroner now ruling her death a homicide. Discovered in this remote stretch of Wyoming's Teton Mountain Range, authorities have not yet said how she died, but named her missing fiancé, Brian Laundrie, a person of interest.
From minute one, Brian Laundry has done absolutely nothing other than to help himself and bide time so that he could cover his tracks and his actions.
2,400 miles away in Florida, the intensifying search for Laundry in this alligator-infested swampland. Laundry's parents told investigators he came to the 25,000-acre reserve for a hike a day before he was named a person of interest in his fiancée's disappearance.
Terrain's very difficult. Essentially, 75% of it's underwater.
After an FBI raid at their family home, Laundry's parents telling NBC News through their attorney he left their house with a backpack and hasn't been seen in a week.
We've been lucky so far.
Last spotted together in Utah, Laundry and Gabby Petito had been documenting their cross-country trip, her disappearance, and his refusal to speak to investigators.
He was very kind of awkward and confused.
Resulting in a flood of tips from those who say they saw Laundry alone or the couple's van.
We came across a white van.
With millions following the case, every encounter, including this run-in with police during a domestic dispute, has now been analyzed on social media. Petito's family fears she may have been killed weeks ago. This affidavit shows her family received a text from her cell phone in late August, which they believe may not have come from her.
Our plan for today is...
Those with answers to this deepening mystery are gone. And now as one search ends, another intensifies.
Our thanks to Miguel Amelguer for that report. Coming up, Congress has just days left to raise the nation's borrowing limit or risk a government shutdown and all the damage that goes with it. There are several new developments on that front. We'll run straight through them, straight ahead. But before we go to break, we want to know, why are you awake? Email your reasons to waytooearly at msnbc.com or tweet me at John Lemire using the hashtag waytooearly. We'll read our favorite answers later in the show. Welcome back to Way Too Early. It's 5:30 on the East Coast, 2:30 out West. I'm Jonathan Lemire. House Democrats have passed a joint bill to fund the government and raise the debt ceiling. The Extending Government Funding and Delivering Emergency Assistance Act passed by a party-line vote of 220 to 211. No Republicans voted for it. The bill would provide funding through December 3rd. Congress has just 8 days to pass a bill or risk a government shutdown. The measure includes more than $28 billion in disaster relief and nearly $7 billion to support Afghan refugees. But the continuing resolution was stripped of $1 billion in funding for Israel's Iron Dome defense system after pushback from progressives. Axios reports, there has never been a situation where military aid for Israel was held up because of objections from members of Congress. The funding will likely be in the defense bill. The bill now goes to the Senate, where Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says Republicans will not vote for it.
This one is not being negotiated on a bipartisan basis because obviously we're not involved in any bipartisan discussion regarding the reckless taxing and spending legislation that they are having apparently some challenges in putting together because of its comprehensive reach and because of its devastating impact on the American economy. So the debt ceiling will be raised, as it always should be, but it will be raised by the Democrats.
McConnell is pushing for Democrats to include the debt ceiling extension in the reconciliation bill. But the path to passing Democrats' $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill remains uncertain. President Biden will host several meetings today with Democrats in the House and Senate to build support for his domestic agenda. The meetings are an effort from the White House to break a stalemate between House progressives and centrists that threatened to derail Biden's plans. That fight was on display yesterday when a group of Democrats doubled down on its insistence that the reconciliation passed both chambers of Congress before the House votes on the bipartisan infrastructure bill. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has said he does not believe the Senate will be ready to vote on reconciliation by the House Democrats' self-imposed deadline. Moderates say the infrastructure bill vote must be held on Monday, as was promised. Joining us now, co-founder of Punchbowl News, Anna Palmer. She is an MSNBC contributor. We are so thrilled she is here with us on set today. Let's start There's plenty to get to. Let's start with the debate over the debt limit. What will it take for this to pass the Senate?
Yeah, I mean, right now, this package is not going to pass the Senate as it is. So basically what we expect to happen is Democrats are going to be forced to move on their own. They've already have another package teed up. They're going to do this government funding vote potentially later this week. Otherwise, we could stumble seriously into a shutdown that moves into the debt ceiling, which is the middle of October. Probably another reconciliation package is what is likely. It's complicated because there's a Votorama and there's a lot of things that need to happen procedurally. But there is a way out for Democrats. They just don't seem to want to take it.
And what will happen if Congress does not actually raise the debt ceiling?
I think you would have a credit default. You're going to have the stock market crisis. I mean, when they didn't do it the last time, it put everything into free fall. You cannot, overestimate how big of an issue this is.
So, and it feels like this would be a particularly bad time for that to happen during a global pandemic. So we just talked about the president's hosting a bunch of Democrats at the White House today. Walk us through those meetings. Where is this going? You know, White House aides have told me repeatedly that at the end of the day, they think that the Democrats, lawmakers, and we obviously know how slim those margins are in the House and the Senate, that they wouldn't want to be the vote to submarine the agenda of a president of their own party.
I think that's probably a safe bet that they don't want to be that vote. But Nancy Pelosi is the person to watch here. She has such a difficult decision to make. Does she move forward and appease the moderates, the Josh Gottheimers of the world with this infrastructure bipartisan vote on the 27th that she promised, and then risk it being tanked by progressives? Nancy Pelosi hates to put up bills and have them fail. So she is trying to she had a big meeting with both sides. She's trying to figure out what her strategy is forward, and no one really knows what she's going to be doing.
So what's the calendar here? There's so much going on at once. The answer might just be everything at the same time.
Yeah.
But what, how can they do all this, and how long is it going to take?
The sequencing is going to be very complicated. It really depends on what happens first on government funding. Then you look at the debt ceiling. Reconciliation and this infrastructure package don't have to get done in the next couple of weeks. And frankly, it's probably going to be a couple of weeks, if not end of the year, when that happens.
So just this dynamic now between the progressives and the moderates. I mean, is there a chance for common ground? And I think there's a sense that that reconciliation package, Democrats would vote for it alone, of course, probably won't end up at $3.5 trillion. It'll shrink to some degree. What do we think falls out of it if it does?
Yeah, I mean, the progressives are holding Democrats hostage here in a way that we haven't seen them do. This is very similar to what the Freedom Caucus did when Republicans had it when they were in control. So the question really is going to be, I think, certainly in terms of funding, do they cut everything just a little bit? Does everything get a haircut? Or are there going to be real programs that are going to fall out, whether that's funding for HBCUs and other kind of priorities among some of the progressives?
And tell us, lastly, what's coming up in Punchbowl News today?
Yeah, we have a packed issue. As always, we have a cheat sheet, which is really fun in terms of what are all of the little things that different members want to keep in the reconciliation package, what the politics are for this Biden administration, who they are meeting with exactly today. So you should check it out at punchbowl.news.
It's a must read. I look at it every day. Anna Palmer, thank you so much for being here. And still ahead, the totally different kind of contraband a gang in New Zealand is accused of smuggling. Way too early. Back in just a minute. Time now for something totally different. Authorities in New Zealand have arrested two suspected gang members for smuggling in a trunk full of KFC into lockdown Auckland. Police spotted the suspicious vehicle on a gravel road as it attempted to evade police. When the car was searched, police found 3 buckets of chicken, 10 cups of coleslaw, as well as other items from the fast food chain, as well as $70,000 in cash. Auckland's level 4 lockdown means all restaurants must remain closed, including no takeout. The two men face possible jail time, the chicken is good, and fines for violating public health guidelines. Former Senator and SNL writer Al Franken targets his past Washington colleagues on both sides of the aisle in his new comedy tour entitled The Only Former U.S. Senator Currently on Tour. The venture is Franken's first extended stand-up run since resigning from the Senate in 2018 after several women accused him of inappropriate kissing and groping, allegations which he has denied. According to the Washington Post, Senators Mitch McConnell, Ted Cruz, Lindsey Graham, Bernie Sanders, and Chuck Schumer, among others, all fall victims to Franken's jabs. The 15-city tour focuses mainly on the comedian's time in politics, a job he often says he misses. The U.S. Space Force is getting an upgrade. The Space Force unveiled its new uniform prototypes at the Air Force Association's Airspace and Cyber Conference yesterday. The Guardian Service Dress prototype includes a Navy coat with six buttons running diagonally up the right side and gray pants. The six buttons, which bear the Space Force emblem, are meant to symbolize the Space Force as the military's sixth service. It didn't take long for people to draw comparisons to Star Trek and Battlestar Galactica on social media. And coming up in Morning Joe, Willie Geist will be modeling this uniform. Still ahead, climate change is dominating the start of the UN General Assembly. We'll talk to Congressman Sean Casten, who's made that issue his top priority. And as we go to break, a look at this date in history. 46 years ago, Sarah Jane Moore attempted to shoot President Gerald R. Ford outside a San Francisco hotel, but missed.
Someone took a shot at President Ford this afternoon, just about an hour ago, in downtown San Francisco. The president was not hit. But a suspect, a woman, is now in custody. And George, we had an eyewitness, and one of our cameramen, Chuck Hastings, shot the film that you're about to see right now. The president just coming out, Chuck Hastings was across the street, and suddenly there was a shot.
When we meet the threat of challenging climate, the challenging climate we're all feeling, already ravaging every part of our world with extreme weather, or will we suffer the merciless march of ever-worsening droughts and floods, more intense fires and hurricanes, longer heat waves, and rising seas?
That was President Biden addressing climate change in his call for unity at the UN yesterday. Joining us now, member of the House Select Committee on the Climate Crisis, Democratic Congressman Sean Casten of Illinois. Congressman, good morning. Thank you so much for being here. You are obviously one of the leaders on the issue of climate change. You heard the president's remarks yesterday. Do you think the president's speech went far enough? We may be having some trouble with the congressman. So we will get him back. We'll work to reestablish his connection in just a moment. This is live television, folks, and it's 5:45 in the morning. In the meantime, we're going to go to answering that immortal question. Because earlier, we asked, why are you awake? One viewer writes, I'm retired, so I have no business being up this early. But I need to get in some Scrabble practice because the ladies who are in their 80s are beating me every week. Yes, pick it up. Another viewer tweeted this. I'm up way too early because I'm that crazy morning person everyone loves to hate. I'm surrounded by a room of them right now. Marlon is up because of those nerve-wracking tree nuts hitting my roof. They sound like small boulders smacking and rolling across the shingles. And Patricia emails to ask this. Do you have an identical twin who is out, who's on at 4:30 p.m., or do you just sleep on the weekends? You know, Patricia, it's a great question. I truthfully don't sleep nearly enough, but I'm here for you, the viewer. Up next, a look at the Axios One Big Thing. And coming up on Morning Joe, we'll hear from former Secretary of State John Kerry about the tone set by President Biden in his address to the UN General Assembly yesterday. Plus, the likely next mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, will join the conversation. I can't miss. Morning Joe is just moments away. Joining us now, member of the House Select Committee on the Climate Crisis, Democratic Congressman Sean Casten of Illinois. Congressman, we've got your back. Thank you so much for being here. As a leader in fighting climate change, you obviously listened to the president's speech yesterday at the United Nations. Do you think he went far enough on the issue?
I think the president is setting exactly the right tone, emphasizing the ambition. I think the important thing now is, will he twist the arms in Congress to get it done? The president made this line in his speech that... What did he say? He said, we will lead the world not just with the example of our power, but God willing with the power of our example. I think that ascribes far too much divinity to a handful of members of Congress whose arms need to be twisted. But we've now got to lead with our feet, not with our words.
Yes, certainly he's made this part of the run-up towards the big climate summit in Scotland in the coming weeks. You also, though, are on another issue, the so-called Fergalicious campaign. Can you tell us that's meant to put the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in the spotlight? Tell us about it.
Well, we've had some fun, and I should first let your back office know we're going to be again on C-SPAN at 10. So if your ratings drop, you'll know what's going on in a few hours. We've been trying to draw some attention to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, in part because so much of our climate action has been held back by one thing: the United States Senate. And as an independent agency that regulates our access to electricity, the type of generation that gets deployed, how we're going to electrify our country, they're really important. And yeah, we've done it with some references to some pretty good hip hop songs. And I dare say I did some pretty good rapping on the floor to try to, you know, up their profile a little bit and draw a little national attention to a really important agency.
Congressman, we have two rules on this show. One is C-SPAN plugs are allowed. The second is that you are not allowed to rap on air. I'm sorry, no elected official is. Let's pivot a little bit here and talk about all the stuff that's consuming Congress at the moment. We talk debt ceiling, you know, obviously the reconciliation package, real debate here between the progressives and moderates. How are you going to get this all done?
It's going to be very complicated over the next couple of weeks. I think what's important to understand about where we are right now is that the president took a decision that we would prioritize the first infrastructure bill in a bipartisan package. And so we got done as much as we could on a bipartisan basis. If you are prioritizing bipartisanship, that means you're not prioritizing children's health. It means you're not prioritizing making sure everybody has access to health care. And most importantly to me, it means you're not prioritizing climate change. So we are now trying to make sure in this framework that we're doing through this weird Senate parliamentary procedure, it's, you know, that the filibuster, the reconciliation process, which is basically Calvin ball. We are trying to make sure that we get all those priorities in. And a lot of members of Congress, a lot of Democrats are obviously advocating for those issues. And it's going to be a close fought thing to make sure that we address them. From my view, we are out of time on climate. This is not something we can punt down the road, notwithstanding the fact that for 30 years that has been the approach of the United States Congress. We have to act now because the West is on fire. People don't know where they're going to live because their house is gone. One in three Americans has had an extreme weather event this summer. We have to act. This is our play. And we got to push hard to get it done and recognize that will involve some high-stakes conversations with a lot of our colleagues.
Congressman Sean Casson, thank you so much for being here this morning. Please come back soon, but you won't be allowed to wrap that time either.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.